All right, so we do have our live stream going, so welcome to everyone who is out there, wherever in the world you are. And so, just a reminder, you've got your field guide, and hopefully in your small groups, that's proving to be a useful resource. So today, the first two chapters, we've gone over like lots and lots of stuff. There's been the first 11 chapters of Genesis. I mean, it's the creation story. We get the flood and everything in between. Last week, we go from Abraham all the way through the birth of Joseph. So that's a lot of family stuff. So we have all these successive stories these first 2 weeks, and then today it feels like we're just pumping the brakes because we got one story in front of us. It's a very long one, perhaps other than the Gospels is the story of Jesus, about the longest narrative focusing on a single character. So we encounter Joseph today. So that's who we get to be with. So as we enter this time, I don't know how many of you. I feel like I'm old school, but I read the paper every day. But I'm new school because I read it on my computer. But it's the layout of the print version. But it's a weird thing. But so if you read the paper today, I've gotten back in the habit of reading the comics. I don't know why. Maybe it's just so if you saw the comics today, if you didn't, that's fine too. But one of the ones that I read, I don't read all of them. I can't stomach all of them. But one that I do enjoy is One Big Happy. And so today's One Big Happy was this. We've got Ruthie talking with her grandma. And so Ruthie says, what's in this cookie, Grandma? Grandma says, cranberries. And Ruthie says, cranberries, but I don't like cranberries. And Grandma says, so maybe now you do like them. And Ruthie says, oh, Grandma, please don't change my mind unless you warn me first. So, but that's cute and funny. But my word of encouragement to us is to see ourselves as Ruthie in this journey together. To say that, you know, maybe we think we've made up our minds about some things or about how things work or even about some of our images of God. But perhaps there are ways that there are things that we think we don't like that we actually do. And I don't know what those are for any of us, but I think it's a richer experience of faith in our relationship with God when we do practice that sense of openness, that our faith isn't a closed book, that we, you know, I was confirmed when I was 15 and that settled it. Well, you know, we've learned and developed and grown a lot since then. And so hopefully we have that sense of openness. Or I guess maybe if nothing else, if we're seeing ourselves as Ruthie, we can all consider ourselves warned. But I think that's an important piece. So here's I think this a similar, I think it's the same concept, but put maybe in a little different way. So this is from a theologian named Susanna Wagner. And she said this, my new thinking both excited me and terrified me at the same time. She shared this in an essay when she was reflecting on her own experience of deconstruction in her faith. She grew up in a very fundamentalist Christian background and realized that for her that was turning out to be a very inadequate way to view the world and one another and view God. And so then as she deconstructed that view to pull it apart to say, what is it that's unsettling about this? That was both an exciting thing because wow, these possibilities, but it's also a terrifying thing because there was this thing that I held on to, this idea of what my faith was about that's changed. But that's an important part of any of our faith journeys, to both deconstruct and then to reconstruct. And so my hunch is, even if we haven't used that language, we've experienced that at different times. Sometimes it's prompted by a different crisis that we've experienced, or just our normal development as human beings. We find ourselves in different places at different times asking different questions, and those are all good things. As I said before, that I think God's more disappointed if we don't ask the questions than think that, well, my question is inappropriate or I shouldn't be asking. Because I would say that if we're only willing to have what we already think, to have kind of what we already think, just we'll only be willing to listen to or have that validated, it winds up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you've been around those people, they're not a lot of fun to be around either. Conversation doesn't go very far. And so I just encourage us to be open to both the excitement and maybe sometimes it is a little terrifying, but we're in this together. And we can also recall that that Jesus, of all people, you know, Jesus himself said, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." And so Jesus even does this deconstruction within the Bible of some of the things that we hear now, that Jesus pulls it apart and gives a different take and a different view. So I think Jesus isn't a bad example for us to follow. Thank you for understanding. That's a joke. That's what I meant. So back to Joseph. So I know that Pastor Caitlin last week talked about some of the family dynamics and, you know, the irony of biblical family values or something of that nature. So I just wanted to start by looking at some family trees. So the first family tree, it's not a biblical family tree. It's my family tree. It's my parents. And so just so we have this as an example, your family tree may look kind of like this, and this isn't the right way to do it. This is just my life. So my parents, Jim and Kathy, had two sons. I'm the older. My younger brother is Ryan. I'm married to Karen. I got to tell you, with this hurricane coming, my family has like the worst name. So I'm married to a Karen. We know what a landmine that name's been. And then we have two kids, Hannah, and then of course Ian. So of all the names to have this week. So that's our family tree. My brother Ryan has a daughter, Maddie. He's married to Vicky. So that's our family tree. I mean, you know your own family tree, and it's kind of a fun thing. A lot of people, you know, who's done that Ancestry.com or those sorts of deals? Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, and then to hear the stories of, you know, I've got this great great uncle who's, you know, and we're all connected. It just shows how we're all connected. So this is my family tree, I guess, coming from my parents. This is Isaac and Rebecca's family tree. You're not supposed to really be able to see it. I mean, it's all there in the Bible. But so we have Isaac and Rebecca. They have two sons also, Esau and Jacob. We talked about those brothers last week. But then what we're dealing with today is Jacob's side of the family. Now, Jacob wanted to marry Rachel, essentially got tricked into marrying Leah, then worked 7 more years, married Rachel, and then also took these two other, I guess, servants as wives as well, is what the Bible says. So he winds up having essentially 4 different wives, has children by all of them, and then Joseph has this privileged status because he's the first, even though he's the 11th child, or the 12th child, 11th son that's born, because Dinah is in there as well, he's Jacob's favorite. So what this tells us, for one, is family can mean a lot of things, and that, especially as we read in the Bible, that we can understand it's a different time and culture and place, but it also means that when someone says, "Well, family is what the Bible says it is." Well, okay, but let's talk about what that means. And it can be an interesting, because you can trot out this family tree, and, you know, we got, you know, I don't know if we hold up polygamy as a family value. So I personally don't. Thankfully, my wife doesn't either. So just as we think about the nature of family and that it does mean different things, just some questions to keep in the back of your mind and maybe even for you to reflect on, or in your groups you can talk about later, even in your life, and then specifically in your life of family. I mean, just to think through things like, who has disappointed you? That's often a kind of a thing that can run through a family, that you know, we don't really want to talk about. We have those things. Another question that often comes up with family, especially at you know, kind of critical times in our lives, is what really matters and how do we know? What really matters and how do we know? Like, I tend to see people embrace what really matters at events like funerals. That's when oftentimes a lot of the other stuff kind of fades away and we see it's not so important and we can hold on to what really matters. Which then, of course, we think about, you know, if the stuff that really matters, then what are we holding on to or we're getting mad about that doesn't really matter? Luther had a great word about this, adiaphora, things that don't matter, things that are indifferent. And then even, this is just to I guess, prime us for Joseph's story, who got special treatment in your family? Who got special treatment in your family? Yeah, maybe it was you, I don't know. Or if no one did, it probably was you. So I don't, I'm just saying. So in the there's all sorts of themes that run through then these last chapters of Genesis. So it's Genesis 37 through 50. I mean, that's 14 chapters here that we have of Joseph's story and the story of Jacob's family here. So one of the themes, just to kind of put out in front of us, and we'll hit on other themes as we move forward, but there's a lot of grief and regret that runs through these pages. Sometimes it's very obvious, other times it's kind of under the surface, but there's plenty of grief and regret that goes along. So it's worth us thinking about what grief we may carry that we're aware of, and then to even think about what are the things that we grieve that we're not even aware of. And some of the times we may be carrying grief that we don't know is when we're getting mad at things and don't know why. It's often a way that we exhibit our grief because we're sad about this thing but don't kind of know it or don't know how to deal with it, so we get upset at something else. And then even thinking about what sort of regrets you have. And what is that about? And then for us as well, you know, how do we experience God through it all? Because that's one of the themes, that's another huge theme that we'll see in here, is that that God is there in the midst of it all. So as we walk through these chapters today, just so you're aware, in the field guide, it's on page 14. And for each chapter in the field guide, it says what's in this chapter. And then there's kind of essentially a section heading just to say, here's kind of the top line theme that's going on or what's happening. And then it's got the specific Bible verses as well. So if you would prefer just to open your own Bible rather than read through the story as it's been condensed together, that's perfectly fine. And you want to know exactly which verses you're encountering. They're all listed right there. So it's certainly available for you. So that's what we'll do, is we'll just walk through these top line themes and see what we learn. So first, we have Joseph being sold by his brothers in Genesis 37. And a couple weeks ago, I asked, I posited that God has dreams. And then God's dreams then get formulated into plans, but those plans are all flexible and adaptable because we have a say in the matter as well. So one of the things that I want to point out, so we've got this, if you're willing to trust that God has dreams, and I think that's an inspirational thing. Dreams are tend to be more fun to talk about. Plans are good, but dreams are really, really good. It's just fascinating to see what happens at the beginning of this chapter in Genesis 37 about what happens to a dreamer. In this case, it's Joseph. In this case, his brothers want to kill him. So sometimes that happens to dreamers. But also, Joseph was 17 years old at the beginning of this story. So, you know, one of the things you might want to consider, might want to talk about in your group is, what were you like as a 17-year-old? And then later on, we'll catch him as a 30-year-old and a 39-year-old. But just as you think about those points in your life, so I know that when I was 17, I knew everything. I had it all figured out. And so I can probably identify with 17-year-old Joseph, and someone probably wanted to throw me in a cistern too. I also know that by the time I was 30, so we had our first child when I was 29. And I got to tell you, when I was 17, my parents were dumb. They didn't know anything. But man, by the time I had a kid and turned 30, my parents had gotten so smart. They knew so much stuff, like how to keep another human alive and all those sorts of things. So it's just to say that we have this incredible, you know, this arc throughout Joseph's life from him as a teenager to him maturing through life. And so then it's worth thinking about in our own journeys as maybe those can be hallmarks for us to think about. And depending on how old, I'm not assuming anyone's age, so whether you're older or younger than any of these numbers, to think about what sort of changes, what sort of development, what sort of growth, what sort of learning you've had or hope to have along those times, which then is the encouragement to say none of us are finished products either, that there are ways that we all continue to grow and learn and develop. Another piece then that is worth us seeing. So this is another theme that runs through this, is we've got in Genesis 37, verses 31 and 32, it says this. Then they took Joseph's robe, these are the brothers, they wanted to get rid of Joseph, slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we have found, see now whether it is your son's robe or not." So what this is interesting is uncovering some family systems dynamics, because if you'll recall, last week, Jacob, along with his mom Rebecca, deceived his father Isaac by putting on that, you know, that hairy whatever it was that he was wearing to trick Isaac. And so here, then, are Jacob's sons bringing a different item of clothing to deceive him. And so that's interesting that this generational deceit is running through. So I'm going to trust you've like either read the chapter or seen the musical, so I don't feel like I need to dive into all the things. So that I'm just trusting that you're aware of these dynamics that are going on. So then we get, after he's taken to Egypt, winds up in Potiphar's household, in charge of all of that. We've got this scene in Genesis 39 of Joseph with Potiphar's wife. So it's interesting to think about. So then she makes this false accusation against him. But what it is that it's another time when Joseph's clothing is used to tell a lie. So we just saw that in Genesis 37. They dipped his coat in blood and told Jacob, well, he's dead. And now it's his cloak, and we read this. When she saw that he had left his garment, because he was getting out of there, left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called out to the members of her household and said to them, "See, my husband has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And when he heard me raise my voice and cry out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." So that's not true. He didn't do that. He ran because he did not want to lie with her. Just an interesting thing. So that's another thing, as we pay attention to these details, to see some of these threads, shoot, no pun intended, that run through, and in this, that was seriously not intended. But this about his garments, both his amazing Technicolor dream coat and his cloak were used to tell lies. So he winds up in the pokey. This isn't, you know, if you've seen the musical, then there's all the songs about it. It didn't make the cut for the story, but we've got the baker and the cupbearer. They have these dreams. So there's that dream theme as well, that of Joseph interpreting dreams. What's interesting, if we start paying attention, is that at the beginning, his dreams that he interprets to his brothers, his interpretation is correct. It's just super annoying in how he shares it. So it's not that he interpreted the dreams wrong, that all these, essentially that his brothers were going to bow down and serve him. We see that that winds up being accurate, but man, he told them that in like the worst possible way. So, you know, maybe you had a brother like that who you kind of wanted to. Once I pushed my brother into, I've gone ice fishing once in my life. My grandpa took us ice fishing. We went on Devil's Lake in North Dakota, which is in, of course, Devil's Lake, North Dakota. And so grandpa had taken the auger, cut the holes in, and Ryan, who's 4.5 years younger than me, and I, we were not renowned as getting along well as kids. And I was always a lot bigger than him, which, you know, now he's a lot bigger than me, so I maybe payback, I don't know. So he's no longer my little, he's my younger brother now. He's not my little brother. But anyway, we were jostling around. My grandpa was there, and you know, he was fishing, and we were pretending like we wanted to fish, and we were just cold and outside, and so we were jostling around. So I just pushed him, and he wound up with his arm in the hole, and grandpa got really mad. It was the end of my ice fishing career too. So anyway, I guess maybe that, and I don't know. I'm sure my brother is being annoying, so he deserved it. Just like Joseph's brothers, I'm sure, thought he deserved what they did to him. So Joseph then, after being accused by Potiphar's wife, winds up in jail and then interprets the dreams of the baker and the cupbearer. When they're freed, both those dreams turn out to be, his interpretations turn out to be accurate. It's bad news for one and good news for the other. The cupbearer was good news, and he promptly forgot about Joseph. So Joseph remained in jail. However, we hear that he, much like what happened in Potiphar's house, basically wound up in charge of the place, even though he was in prison. Then he gets released because they do remember that the cupbearer remembers that Joseph had interpreted this dream. It was correct. Now we're at age 30. So Joseph is at age 30. That's in Genesis 41. What's interesting is if you read the text is that Pharaoh has these dreams, these kind of duplicate dreams. We read that the wise men show up. I mean, it's like, didn't they read the Christmas pageant script? Wise men show up following the star. That's really a church nerd joke. But again, if we pay attention, we can see how some of these traditions follow through. That the wise men, there was kind of this idea of these magicians and astrologers that are included back in Genesis. So then we can be aware of perhaps what sorts of roles they played when they do show up for the Christmas pageant. They couldn't interpret Pharaoh's dreams. The cupbearer remembered, oh yeah, this guy in prison. So Pharaoh calls on Joseph. Joseph comes, interprets the dreams. And what's clear here now too is that he's grown in wisdom, because his interpretation of the dream, which he credits, he says, it's not my gift, it's God's gift. It's not that I'm doing this, that God is doing it through me. But so he's clearly grown in wisdom over the years by both asserting that, to say that this isn't me, but this is a gift that God has given me, which, you know, then we can think about maybe the things that we thought we were just always so good at an earlier point in life, we can see how God has given us this gift and then trusted us to use this gift, whatever it may be, responsibly. And so he interprets the dreams, and then, interestingly, there's a lot of long-range planning and patience that works here, because it's 7 years of bumper crops, these first 7 years of abundance, and then 7 years of famine. So they have to plan for all of these things. And there's a very important detail here, another thread that runs through. This one has nothing to do with clothing, but we hear time and again that the Lord was with Joseph. So the Lord is with Joseph when he was in Potiphar's house. So in equipping him and empowering him so that he could be entrusted with the responsibilities of running the household. We hear that even though he was in jail, the Lord was with Joseph. And then again, he showed the responsibility and was entrusted with the ability to essentially run the jail, even from his position as a prisoner. And then with Pharaoh, Joseph acknowledges in chapter 41 that it's God who is with him, giving him these interpretations of Pharaoh's dreams, that it's not Joseph doing it. And so through everything that he's experienced, the good things, the bad things, and everything in between, through all the grief that he's experienced, all the regret, my hunch is as he grew in stature and wisdom and years, he regretted how he communicated with his brothers. Or maybe you could talk about that. Do you think he regretted it? I kind of think he did, but maybe not. Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. And I think we look, it's his family system. He's stuck. But he came from a deceitful family. And so he was living out what he had learned as the child of someone who practiced deceit to get to his spot in life.
So he really didn't change totally, though.
No, and that's... Well, he grew in wisdom, and let's be clear, let me state again, only hero of the Bible is God. We're not going to pretend like Joseph is some impeccable character here. He certainly has his character defects even as he grows in wisdom and stature, but that makes him a more complicated and an interesting character to see what motivates him to act with deceit, even though there's this other part of him that's clearly matured and grown. Right, and the New Testament, and our lives, and each one of us, where there are the, you know, we're all complicated in these ways. Yeah.
The main thing here is that Joseph wanted to see if they were sorry for what they had done.
He may have wanted to see if they were sorry for what they had done. Maybe just want a little payback. I think that's an interesting conversation for you to have in your groups. And so, yeah, so we get to that. And here's the other thing, is that even though Joseph certainly wasn't perfect, that he was still deceitful, God was still with him. And if we're willing to be candid with ourselves, we know that, well, we have capacity to do all those things too. And we're not perfect. And God is still with us. And so then what do we do in response to that? So then we do get to Joseph and his brothers during the famine. So now Joseph is around 39 years old because we're into the famine, so 7 years and into the famine. So he's starting to feel he's in Egypt, which is important for us to know. And this is part of that deceit. Joseph, rather than he recognizes them, which is kind of interesting. It's been 22 years. He recognizes them, but he spoke through an interpreter to disguise his identity, you know, because he was speaking the language of Egypt, and his brothers were not. They were speaking their language. So he could understand them, but they couldn't understand him, but he made them think that he didn't. And then another fascinating family dynamic is when Reuben, in Genesis 42:22, you know, he basically says, "I told you so." To say, you know, we came here and it's not going to be useful. It's not going to be fruitful. And so then it is important for us to wonder again about this deceit, about him disguising his identity, about him putting the silver cup in Benjamin's bag after all of that happens, rather than just being open at the beginning. But then what's interesting in all of this is every time we turn around, Joseph is weeping. So starting in chapter 45, or excuse me, 42, we have just Joseph weeping all the time. So we read, "He turned away from them, from his brothers, and wept. Then he returned and spoke to them." So this is well before he revealed himself to them. But he was somehow moved, but not apparently moved enough to let them know what was happening. Chapter 43, when he sees Benjamin, with that, Joseph hurried out because he was overcome with affection for his brother, and he was about to weep, so he went into a private room and wept there. So that's interesting. He's both deceiving his brothers, and there's a sense of affection. So there's that tension, and I wonder you know, where are the places in our lives that we have that tension? Like there's, we have that affection, but man, we're doing this thing that seems to undermine it as well. Another scene with his brothers, he went out and, you know, he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it in the household of Pharaoh. I don't know how loud he was crying. But this is, again, was about his encounter with his brothers. Later in Genesis 45, then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, while Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them, and after that his brothers talked with him. So this is as he's revealing his identity. And then we get to his reunion with his dad. Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet his father Israel in Goshen. He presented himself to him, fell on his neck, and wept on his neck a good while. And then at the end of Jacob's life, then Joseph threw himself on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And one last time, this is as the brothers are like, oh, shoot, dad's gone. We can't, what do we do? So, well, let's go tell Joseph that dad told us to tell him. That's what happened. So again, this deceit runs deep. I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. So it's just interesting that that's yet another theme that runs through. And what do we make of all of that? And of course, you know, we already hit on this, but we've got this reunion of Joseph with his family. When it comes out who he is, they're reunited, and comes out in the open. But what's interesting is for us to consider and for you to think about in your groups or as you reflect on Joseph's story is who has agency. Who has agency? That is the ability to act and affect others in this. So, for instance, in Genesis 45, we read this. Joseph said to his brothers, come closer to me. They came closer. He said, I'm your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are 5 more years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt. So that makes it sound like, you know, God did all of this. But Joseph also says, do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended. So that was even, you did it. So he's saying to his brothers, it was your agency that God intended it for good in order to preserve a numerous people as he's doing today. So I would say is that even there, when we get to a satisfying ending, looking back, it feels like, well, that was God doing it all along, that this is kind of what God intended. But if we look back through, it was the brothers who did this, and God worked with what God had to work with, which was the brothers doing these things and then Joseph being in these places with these gifts that Joseph was willing to use in the ways that he did. So then another place where this happens, so this is Joseph saying, or the brother saying, My money has been put back. Here it is in my sack. At this, the brothers lost heart and turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? So they're saying, God did this. But 3 verses earlier, it said, Joseph then gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to return every man's money to his sack, to give them provision. So it was Joseph who had the agency who did it. The brothers thought, well, God did it. So I think it's just interesting to play with that, to say, what does it mean? Because then again, what are the ramifications if you think that, nope, it was God who did it, it was all a part of God's plan or whatever, then the responsibility is on us to say, well, then what does that mean? What is the nature of our ability, our agency, our free will? How much has God determined? Or do we even have that? And we're not Calvinists, so actually we're not worried about that. So anyway, Romans 8:28, so just a teaser of what's to come in the New Testament. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. which I see as it's saying that God takes what's available and tries to use it for good, not that God makes everything happen the way it does, because otherwise, you know, all the bad stuff, if we truly have a loving God, wouldn't be happening if God could simply undo it. But those are the sorts of concepts for us to wrestle through, and as we continue to be Ruthie discovering the cranberries, to say, well, what do we think about this? What do we think about this? So just a couple last thoughts. I think there are probably some connections that we can make to the parable of the prodigal sons in this, with these family dynamics. And so that's in Luke 15, 11 through 32. It might be worth thinking about how does a conversation between that parable that Jesus tells about that father and his two sons, what sort of conversation does that have with Joseph's story? And then another thing is to think about, because next week, it's been 3 weeks, we've gotten through the book of Genesis, which feels like a sprint through Genesis. But then we realize there's 31 weeks of the story. We spent three in Genesis, and there's 66 books in the Bible, and we're through one of them. But that just tells us what a rich library we have in front of us, that even though we'll do this high-level overview for these coming months, there's a lot more that we can get into as well. But one of the things that's worth thinking about, or thinking of Genesis, is a bit of a prequel to Exodus. Some have even posited that Exodus was the first book of the Bible. And then the Genesis was edited together as a way to say, this is how we got here. Because Exodus, they begin in Egypt. Well, how did we get here, and why are things the way that they are? So, for instance, you could think of Genesis as a prequel or as an overture for Exodus and beyond. So, again, we've talked about Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat a little bit. The musical begins with an overture, which then is this introduction of all these musical themes that will run throughout. I am quite certain that was the last piece of music that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote for Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, because he had to compose all the rest of the pieces in order to put together this overture at the beginning that introduced everything. You don't start from the overture. I mean, you start with the overture, but the overture comes from everything else. Or if you look at other typically movies or TV shows that have prequels, which is then doing world building to explain how we got here. That's why there are these Star Wars prequels. I would say go watch them, but they're not very good. But it's to do this, even though we know what's going to happen with Darth Vader, we look back to see how did he get here? How did things get to where they are? Or if you're a sitcom person and you watched The Big Bang Theory, now there's Young Sheldon to explain how Sheldon got to be how he was. Big Bang Theory came first, and then we've got this prequel of Young Sheldon to talk about that. I'll admit I've never watched either of those shows, but I just know what the premise is. So I'm neither recommending nor steering anyone away from either show. Or if you're a Yellowstone fan, and then 1883 is a prequel to say, again, talk about family dynamics, how family plays through, or how things got to where they are in the contemporary setting of Yellowstone versus 1883 when the ranch was being settled. So what Genesis is trying to, one of the things it's trying to answer is the question, how did we get here? How did we get here? So one of the things as the story emerges that we know that there's this relationship that God has with the people of Israel. Well, how did we get here? Well, there's this man named Jacob who wrestled with God, and he was given the name Israel, and he wrestled with God, and that's what Israel means, is wrestles with God, which then is a powerful testimony. You say, well, what did this wrestling look like, and how does that explain, what's the origin story for how we got to where we are? And it's important for us to know that Exodus is a concept then, as we get to that next week, that runs through the entire Bible. That Jesus' story itself is an Exodus story. It's defined as such in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 9, verse 31. After the transfiguration, Jesus says he's preparing for his departure. The word literally is Exodus. And so that's how big of a theme we get to next week. Or Matthew 2, after Mary and Joseph flee from King Herod and his tyrannical rule, they flee to Egypt, and then when it's all safe, they leave, and then Matthew 2, 13 through 18 is the story, and so it can be said, out of Egypt I called my son. Just like out of Egypt is where God led the people in the Exodus. So again, that's why we do all of this work through this, so we see these themes that emerge. All right, you are awesome. So have great conversation. Thank you so much for being here, and we'll see where God leads us in the coming weeks. Take care, everyone.